I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. This episode, well, I talked to David McCormann and it was a real joy, an absolute joy. David and Bernard Butler are responsible for one of my all-time favourite records, which is Yes. And I'm very aware that you're all familiar with that record because it is an absolute masterpiece. And I just sent David a message on Instagram saying that I'd love to speak to him. And he was super kind and replied. And then he sent his song tracks over, which you're about to find out what they are. And they're wonderful, as is David. And we find out at the end about, you know, what he's got coming up, and there's some fantastically exciting things coming your way. So make sure at the end you keep a note of what's coming up, because I think some of these things are going to be absolutely remarkable. Anyway, before we get on with my chat with David, a few thank yous. I want to thank the team at Blue Murder Club Podcast. They produce this, so go check out the Blue Murder Club Podcast. It's a true crime pod, and it's wonderful. So go give that a listen. I'd like to thank Scroobius Pip, and it was Pip who was responsible for me stumbling into the world of podcasting many, many years ago, and it's been absolutely life-changing, to the point that, you know, it's 99% of my work life now, and you know, and I get to, you know, take an hour out of my day and sit down and get to speak to people like David, which just absolutely lifts your day. And the fact that there's people out there like you lot that listen makes it even more special. So thank you. And big thanks to Pip for opening the door to this world. If you'd like to support the podcast, then let me tell you how you can do it. You can just head over to any of the three big hitters of social media. I'm too old for TikTok, but Instagram, Facebook and Twitter, just search Off the Beat and Track and give us a follow. That's a really good way of supporting the podcast. And while you're over there, if you want to share it or retweet it, that'd be amazing. And if you really want to support the podcast, then you can do that for a dollar. And it's a dollar a month. And then what that does is that gives you access to my Patreon. And over on there, I put all the videos, so you can watch all my chats over on Patreon. You get access to hundreds of radio shows, hundreds of unreleased episodes, loads and loads of sort of playlists and mixtapes. So there's loads of stuff. I try and put a few bits up each week that I don't put out to the general public. And you also get invited to a monthly live show, which is over Zoom, and you all jump on and we pick a subject. I've just announced one today, actually, and we're going to do your essential album. So you'll get to come along and get involved in the chat, and then sometimes we release them as well. So it's your opportunity to feature on the podcast. And you can find out about that and everything else at the website, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. And it's off the beat and, it's not beaten. I've been telling you this for 500 episodes now, so you should know. Offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. And also, I've just mentioned there that we're over 500 episodes in. If this is your first time listening, then hello. It's great to have you, but you're super late to the party. So why don't you play catch up? Go check out that back catalogue because, I've been so lucky to have had the likes of The Killers, Public Enemy, The Foo Fighters, God, the list goes on, you know, through to some real acting heavyweights like Maxine Peake, Thomas Turgoose, Michael Smiley, David Duchovny, and all your favourite comedians. I could go on forever listing all these guests I've had. I've been so lucky, and you can go and check them all out for free. And while you're checking them out, why not subscribe to the podcast? Right, I think that's all the kind of pre-show waffle done, and now we can get on to some great chat, and that comes in the way of today's guest. So please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the delightful David McCormann.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. David, how are you?
Good. Sorry, someone's just buzzing me on my phone and now switched it off. Yes, I'm good.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's wonderful to have you join us for the podcast. And you've already sent your tracks over to me, and I've had a look, and I'm very, very excited to discuss them today. And so okay. Let's jump straight in and get the playlist started, because I always ask guests to kick off the playlist with the song that they regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
Song that made you gasp.
This is a cracker.
Okay.
So the song that has the greatest ever intro, please.
Let's Go Crazy by Prince. I would argue for. I remember the first time that I heard that very specifically. I was in Guyana. I was at home in a suburb of Georgetown, the capital, called South Rhymeville. I was alone. My mother was at work. My sister was at school, so I'm not sure what I was doing at home. But I had the radio on, GBC, Guyana Broadcasting Corporation, and this song just came out of the speakers. And the best description, the description I always use, is that it just pinned me to the wall.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell is that? It sounded like somebody had baked a cassette in the sun and put it on. It was playing. And then this thing just unfolded on the radio. And it began with him saying, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through the thing called life, electric world, life, it means a mighty long time, but I hear today that there's something else in the afterworld. And I was like, oh. And then that guitar solo, and it was just the most extraordinary record I had ever heard in my life. And I wouldn't say that my musical taste was really that developed then. And then right at the end of it, they said, and that was Prince. So it's the first time that I ever heard Prince. And, you know, I really treasure that moment because I was alone when I heard Prince for the first time. And what's interesting about that is that it wasn't the first time that I saw him, because my friends at school all had magazines of this really strange looking man who kind of fascinated me because he was different to everything that I expected from Black American R&B singers at that period. They were all very 80s, you know, Jerry Curl and sharp sort of Michael Jackson-esque leathers and whatnot. But Prince was walking around with his pubes showing in a trench coat and long boots. And he was like, what is this guy? And so from that to hearing him on the radio for the first time, and from that day I became something of a devotee, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, what an introduction to Prince, Let's Go Crazy.
No, what? I mean, really, of all of the introductions to any song I can ever think of, that's just got to be the most perfect. Alone, darning a sock, you know, completely unexpected, you know, completely uninvited, and just there. And that, well, it is one of the greatest introductions. So, and it's the first thing that came to mind when I looked at the list. It was like, great introduction, Let's Go Crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what, David? I've done over 500 of these episodes now, and no one's chose that. And I'm stunned because it's so iconic, and it's such a... and I'm always curious as to what side of the intro people lean on, because a lot of the time people go for them kind of like long, stretched out intros like Let's Go Crazy, whereas some people just go... Help by the Beatles, just bang straight in, and so with that in mind, when you're making music and the way that people would have been listening to music when your career first started to how people listen to music now, the way in which it's done is by lots of different formats now. We're seeing that a lot of songwriters are utilising things like TikTok and to get their music out there. And obviously there's Spotify playlists now, which are apparently quite important in getting your music out to more people, rather than perhaps when your career started, when there was still, I guess people were still leaning towards, you know, getting playlisted on the radio stations and the music press and such like that. The fact that the more modern trends, whether it's trying to grab people by Spotify or, you know, these rapid thumbs that you're seeing on telephones with TikTok and things like that, it seems that the sort of attention spans getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And that does seem to be representative in maybe commercial pop music, I guess. I'm really taking my time with this question, but I'm going to get there in the end, David. And I just want to know, like, with your creative process, does any of these trends in how people are getting their music filter through into your creative process anymore?
Well, for one thing, I would say that you have to be prepared to not have your entire album listened to anymore. And it's very much about making sure that every track is great. But then that's always been the case anyway. But I do remember a time where I treated some things like B-sides, like, you know, specifically making a B-side. But I wouldn't say that I do that anymore.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
What's that?
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, that albums aren't necessarily seen as a piece of art and a body of work maybe as much as they used to be? And the importance of the B-side, because it was access to more music, and it felt like there was a little hidden secret on the flip side of the single. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I don't really feel that there's a great deal that we can do about the march of time. I mean, I think if this period that we're living in now has taught me anything, and not just the technology, but if you think about something like Brexit, for example, I was born before we went in, and I've lived long enough to see us go out. And I mean, the thing about living is that change happens. So this popular song, long player album, does seem to be a phenomenon of the 20th century. And we're in the 21st now. Things are going to change and people aren't going to consume in the way that they did. So I think for those of us who've traversed from the 20th century to the 21st, there is some frustration. But I mean, I do think we have to get with the times. I mean, the other thing that I do is I have a process that I call real thoughts in real time. But some people have said it's just like, it's exactly what David Bowie did. But if I have any unforced thoughts that sound good to me, I write them down in my smartphone. And I've got this massive list of things that I've said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. The minute I start to work on it and change it into something, I stop, because it's like I'm contrived. So the uncontrived ideas all get stored in my smartphone. And then when I sit down with Sean to write, it's like I go straight to my smartphone and see which lyrics stick and which ones don't. The other thing is that recently Sean and I decided that we wanted to create a chant, write a song that was a chant, and we decided that we do it with AI. Now, there's a lot of scaremongering about AI, and I think that we probably do have good reason for concern, but at the same time, I think that if you just want to like get some essential words, that you can have a chat with AI as an assistant. And I've been doing that quite a bit recently, and it's like having a conversation with Wikipedia. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we can all be Luddites, and I am a Luddite in many ways. I mean, my music taste strains after 2010. I mean, it's a definite change. I'm 56, I'm set in my ways, I know what I like. A lot of what I hear is like, oh yes, but I remember Bowie doing that in this year and blah, 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 blah. And because of that decentralization, I don't feel that I have the need for television anymore. The water cooler has basically evaporated, vanished. It's like we all live these bespoke technological lives now. So, you know, you speak about Spotify playlists. I know people who like to sit in front of YouTube for a couple of hours on a Saturday night. Yeah. I know some people who like to kind of just like collect the vinyl that they haven't had. I mean, but we're in the 21st, we're 23 years into the 21st century now. So I don't think I can get too hung up on the fact that albums aren't as important to listeners as they once were.
Okay.
But it makes sense that they were important to my mum.
Yeah. Well, let's go back and talk about the sort of formative years then.
That was a long-winded answer.
It was a long-winded question.
That's true.
David, can you tell me the first song that you remember that had an emotional impact on you, please?
Yeah, it was 1975. I was at home in Norfolk with my mother and my sister. My sister had just discovered crochet, and I seem to remember my mother and my sister working on this like really fabulous kind of lots of purples and blues and reds crochet quilt thing. And Top of the Pops was on, and there was this guy, and I don't remember his face as much as I remember the light on his shiny curly hair, and this sound was just coming out of him. And I would say that was the day that the idea of doing that myself became really interesting. And it was a song that I had heard I couldn't tell you how long before, but I had heard it before in an old black and white Busby Berkeley film, one of the Gold Diggers films. And it was another version of that. And it was Art Garfunkel singing "I Only Have Eyes for You," which, if anybody asks, is my favorite song, is my favorite record ever. And there have been people who've been disappointed by that because they think that because I am what I am, but I should say Marvin Gaye or Stevie Wonder or something. But actually, I can't think of a record that I love as much as that, other than the version of it that I heard from the Flamingos.
Yeah.
I've got two favorite records, the Flamingos version of "I Only Have Eyes for You" and Art Garfunkel's, but I think that Art has the edge. It's just I suppose people call me the Croydon Choir Boy sometimes. And I think when I think of Art Garfunkel, I think of an overgrown choir boy.
Absolutely.
Like a fiery angel.
Yeah, yeah. If I had to ask you, David, to sort of pinpoint the emotion, what would it be?
Transportation, escape. What's the word I'm looking? Transcendence. Elevation above the ordinary, mundane, into a very magical world.
Yeah,
I think lots of records do that, but I think that he does it in a really exquisite way. And that voice, I mean, that voice is absolutely one of my favorites of all time, based on this one song, because I have actually sought out other Art Garfunkel records and they don't quite rise to this occasion for me. And some people think he's cheesy. I think he's amazing with Paul Simon. And in some respects, I think that it took me years to notice how nuanced and how good a singer Paul Simon was because Art Garfunkel was in the way.
Yeah.
It's a transporting vocal. It's like a song from another world. That's what I would say.
That's the best way to describe a good record, if it's otherworldly. I think that's what makes something so beautiful.
Mm.
David, you mentioned
beauty.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Norfolk.
Yes.
So was that where growing up was?
No, I was born in Croydon and I moved to Norfolk probably when I was about 7 or 8. My mother decided to get out of Croydon and move to a seaside town, as you do.
Yeah. How was that?
Interesting. I was the only black boy in my school.
Yeah.
And it was the same for my sister. And I think historically, the thing I remember most was Roots. And I think Roots was 75 or 76, but there was this really intrusive curiosity on my first day. I mean, we're talking about being in the playground, surrounded by students, speaking about you as an object and feeling your hair and saying, oh, his hair is really spongy, isn't it? I'm like really kind of unabashed curiosity from these kids. And then Roots came onto TV. And it was a different, it was as if though the kids in the playground suddenly realized where I came from.
Yeah.
And it was quite painful personally, because it meant that I spent a good 6 months being called Toby and Kunta Kinte. And my sister, at the school she went to got called Kizzy. And I remember one kid coming up to me once and saying that they'd gotten rid of people. You know, and he was talking about his father being a member of the National Front. So yeah, it was challenging, but good geographical location to have on the CV.
I'm so sorry, David. Bear with me 2 seconds. I'm just aware that my microphone cut out then, so hopefully you can hear me a little better now.
I can.
Oh, fantastic!
Much better.
When you was at school, and I presume, I mean, the time scale that you're talking about there was, you know, I guess was the period where the National Front was probably peaking towards the sort of mid-70s to late-70s, and I can't imagine how that must have felt, but on the actual sort of side of sort of what you wanted to do and what you wanted to be, was you formulating your own kind of ideas then as to what you wanted to do when you left school at that point?
No, I mean, I think I'm somebody who is constantly surprised by what I have been capable of. And there were things that I was good at, and people who weren't me noticed that. And it's taken me years to appreciate that I could read, write, sing, because I didn't feel as if those things were taken seriously when I was a child by anybody in particular. But I think also one of the things that you seem to be picking up on is that I did actually retreat into a sort of a fantasy world. Because, it wasn't always friendly, and it was very difficult for my mother because she was a single mother. And so on TV, there was a lot of escape. And in that scenario, I guess I began to absorb the idea that entertainment was something that I could do. But I wouldn't have said that I was aware of being a capable singer at the time.
Was any of those sort of more creative and artistic sides of, you know, your personality encouraged at school?
Yeah, I mean, I remember standing on stage in a church and reading Psalm 23 and being selected to participate in the Christmas play. But all of this struck me as mysterious. Like, why are they asking me? I think the other really important thing was that my sister, and I'm sure I've asked her, but I've forgotten why, she suddenly became obsessed with the Madonna and Child. And she was painting it constantly. Like, she'd come home and just start drawing the Madonna and Child. And my mother's friend started giving her Italian postcards of Italian painters. And that, once again, I was when I got back from Guyana in 87 and started going to European museums and galleries, I was recognizing all of these paintings and somehow forgetting that my sister was a person who attuned me to them. And in the last few years, I've been doing a lot more work in terms of art and art history. And I'm very clear now that this is absolutely something that began with my sister in that moment where she had that. She's an artist now and an illustrator. Absolutely began in that moment where she was completely fascinated by that iconography.
Well, we're talking so much about school. Can you tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please?
Well, I went to Broadmead Primary School, and then I went to Peterhouse School in Norfolk, and then I went to Grove Primary in Guyana, and then I went to secondary school at Queen's College. So this is a selection from that. And the reason that I've chosen it is because I remember it representing this moment of really shocking transition. And when I got to Guyana, it was all about Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and artists like that, your more melodic reggae music.
Yeah.
And then it seemed that one day there was this tune, and it was immediately followed by another tune about diseases, the most dangerous diseases. I don't know if you know the most dangerous diseases, and about being afflicted with poliomyelitis and all of these itises. and that seemed to herald the arrival of dancehall. It was Bonnie Wailo, who was associated with a particular kind of reggae, doing something that sounded very hip hop, and then bang, overnight, these really nice, churchy school children were doing the most outrageous things on the dance floor to this new thing called dance hall. And then people like Yellow Man, yeah, you know, became these huge stars. But this Back to School by Bonnie Wailer seems to have been the signaling that something really massive was about to change in Jamaican music.
Did you...
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As he got to sort of towards the end of school, was you starting to sort of sing more then? And was you aware of what you could do?
There was an incident in a music class where we were doing Close to You as a school choir. And
Carpenters.
Yes. And my music teacher, Avis Joseph, she sort of like said, "Who is that?" And everybody stopped. And then it was a case of, no one's going to admit to that. And she wouldn't say what it was that she heard. But over time, she sort of like kept us all back until it was about five boys left in the room, and I was one of them. And at, by that point, we were like, you know, we're all like going, we were like, you know, what have we done? She wouldn't say.
Yeah.
And then in the end, I just thought, okay, just let rip, just like me. And they said, McAlmont, it's you. And I'm like, what have I done? And then I said, what is it? After everybody left, I said, I'm sorry, but why did you single me out just then? And she said, because you have a beautiful voice, and I wanted to know who it was. You should always own up to a voice like that. And I started singing in church, but the thing I remember about Guyana was that you had to be a local version of a big star. And so you had a really good friend of mine, Aubrey de Guiar, he was the local Stevie Wonder, which meant that if anybody else was going around singing Stevie Wonder songs, they kind of had to get his permission, because it's like, you know, that's
crazy.
That's my portfolio. Yeah. And of course, I mean, I think at that time, my favorite singer was Whitney Houston. And there was absolutely no way that I could be the local Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
And I remember I went back to Guyana recently about 5 years ago, and karaoke has taken over. I mean, honestly, I need to go to Japan to just see how prevalent karaoke is there, because Guyana is very much its second territory. And I think that's very much linked to the fact that the big names never came. Yeah. And so people, you know, had their songs that they were known for. My mother was known when she was a child for singing Walking My Baby Back Home, in her village in the 1930s. So, went into a karaoke bar and I said, I'm going to do Whitney. And I did Saving All My Love For You. I remember these people sort of like stopping on the street and saying, is that man dad?
Fantastic. So talking about those early days at school where you realized that you was in a complete minority, and that must have been so difficult, and to then sort of, you know, feel reluctant to put your hand up and say, yeah, that was me singing. Where did the confidence come from that as a fan of your music, you know, from the very first time I saw you on television, I was like, there's a front man, and you know, you seem to just pour confidence in your performance, and I just wonder where that come from.
Church, probably. I accepted Christ as my personal savior at the Assemblies of God in Georgetown when I was 13 years old, and in church they have this thing called choruses, which is also how I learned to play the tambourine. And slowly, I took a lot of knocks, a lot of people, because the aim then was to sing under something called the anointing. And I really wanted, you know, I really aspired to singing under the anointing. And in Guyana, it wasn't a TV country. There was no TV, unless you had a lot of money and you could afford to pay one of the men who was one of the gangsters who was pirating TV. But my mother wasn't like that. So there was a lot of focus on music, and I sang a lot at church. And slowly, eventually, I began to get a lot of encouragement. And in church, I became the guy who sang El Shaddai. There's a famous contemporary Christian singer in the United States called, I wonder what you would make of this, called Amy Grant. And I loved Amy Grant, and she did this beautiful song called El Shaddai. And whenever I sang it, it really moved people. And that kind of modest success meant I tried other material, but it didn't always work. But whenever I sang El Shaddai, it really moved people. And I think that's where the confidence with the ballad and nerviness about taking on up-tempo tracks came from. Yeah. You know, I think more up for doing the up-tempo stuff now than I've ever been in my life. It's taken me this long.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Tell me the first song you remember buying from a record store, please, David.
Well, okay. The first record I ever bought, personally.
Or if someone, you can have one that was gifted to you, and you can have one that you bought.
Yeah, this has really confused me, because the first time I was moved by a celebrity death, as it were, was Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
I remember going to the toy shop to buy Duke Marbles. I don't know. Do you remember Duke Marbles?
No. Explain.
When we were playing marbles, you know, you got those ones with the colour in the middle.
Yeah.
Well, they called them dukes, but they were just the marble with nothing in them.
Wow.
And I was fascinated by them, and I got some pocket money, and I went to the toy shop to buy a bag, because I just love to look at them and play. I never played marbles in my life. And I remember being in the toy store and the radio saying that Elvis Presley had just died. This was 1977, so I was 10. And, like, you know, beginning to cry, going home and raising a glass of water to him with my sister and like saying, you know, long live the king or something like that. And I remember this record from that period, but it's the month after he died. And the month after he died, there seemed to have been a crowd of, I think it was about 9 albums in the top 40 and about 20 some singles. And this was one of them. And the only thing I can tell you is that my mother had really erratic taste choices. I mean, all of the albums were the crooners, but the cheesy crooners. Right? So my mother was Bing Crosby, Perry Como, Dean Martin. I can still listen to Perry Como, but I don't listen to Bing and Dean anymore. But I think my mother's best taste as far as crooners go was Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
But she bought all of these singles, and Return to Sender is one of the ones that I remember really enjoying.
Wonderful. What a record.
But then much later, when I was at high school, I bought In Square Circle by Stevie Wonder. That was the first time I spent money on a record.
And obviously you wasn't allowed to be Stevie Wonder because someone else had got that, right? That was someone else's gig. And you had to be Whitney. But tell me about the importance of Stevie Wonder for you. Was Stevie an artist that at that point, you know, much like Prince, you become a lifelong fan of?
Prince felt more like a cult.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is? Because I think that's a really interesting thing you just said there. Because I, much like you, you know, we're a very similar age, and seeing Prince, you know, the first time I see him would have been around about that time as well, and it would have been on Top of the Pops, and it would have been seeing the video to When Doves Cry with all the scenes from Purple Rain, and just thinking, who's this guy on this motorbike that just looks fucking otherworldly? Like, and I couldn't understand what I was watching, and I couldn't take my eyes off him, and it was absolutely fantastic, and it felt like, I guess, it just felt a little weirder, and I think when you're young, you're always a little bit drawn. Well, I certainly was to the sort of the weirder, darker things that you think, oh, what's going on there? That's a bit strange. I can't put that in a box. And I think, like, that's why it kind of, when you said about cult sort of status, I thought, yeah, that's exactly how I saw it.
Yeah. I think that's it. I think I remember having an argument with a school friend once about who was better, you know, and it was later I found out that this was actually quite a wide conversation, but it was, and the media were, the magazines were definitely engaged in it. This kind of pitting Prince against Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And his argument was that Michael Jackson has sold more. What does that tell you? And my argument was that Prince was the more talented. He played guitar. He was more experimental and so on. But I think that, I don't know, it might be a bit like Sly and the Family Stone. I saw Lionel Richie at the Ivan Velo Awards a few years ago, getting his Lifetime Achievement Award, and he spoke about how Black Radio told him his career was over because he released a ballad. He was talking about Once, Twice, Three Times a Lady. Yep. It was like Black Radio was like, no, we don't do that. And then you think about Whitney being booed at the Black Music Awards because of her sound. I think Prince sort of fell in the same category. It's like, he was probably the first black axe hero after Hendrix.
Absolutely.
So this was like, we don't do that. We expect that from, we expect to hear that rock sound from Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
We don't expect it from Prince. So I think also that Guyana is still very much a Christian country. Mm. So, you know, Prince is if you're a born again Pentecostal Christian type, Prince is a bit dodgy, isn't he? And so I remember people saying that Prince was satanic.
Really?
You know, whereas, yeah. I mean, I don't know how he would have felt about that, but no, you can't be, you know, you can't be walking around in bikini pants, in trench coats, like and behaving like that and expect to become anything more than the cult. Not in a country like Guyana, anyway. Whereas Michael Jackson was incredibly hip, but Stevie Wonder was. He was more like a sort of prophet elder to the Guyanese people, I would say. That, you know, when we spoke of Stevie Wonder, it was with real reverence and respect. But Michael Jackson was very much for the young people.
Yeah.
And Prince was for the young people in the know. And I think I've always felt different. It's just circumstantial, but after Croydon, being the only black boy in my school, going to Guyana and being the only English boy in my school, you know, that sort of made me feel a little bit different to people. And then I was a born again Christian at my high school when everybody else was going out and partying and having sex. And so I always felt a little different to everybody else. And so I suppose that I appreciated that there was something different about it. Plus, I'd also had enough years, because I left here when I was 11, of watching Top of the Pops. And so one of the things that appealed to me about Prince was that he sounded like the stuff that I remembered from Top of the Pops. And leaving here in 77, it was, leaving here in 78, it was sort of the first chapter of British punk in a way.
Yeah.
And we'd just come through glam rock. And I remember my sister and I loved Bohemian Rhapsody. So I went to Guyana and suddenly that music didn't count. It was like only the songs that were big on the American R&B chart that really registered at Guyana radio. And so rock was gone. And Prince brought it back into my life, I would say.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You touched on Top of the Pops there, and I think anybody sort of growing up in the UK, that was, you know, that was your gateway into seeing what pop star, you know, what your favourite pop stars looked like. And, you know, you got to see your, you know, the only place really, because not many people I knew could afford MTV, you know, that was where you would watch music videos and you'd see the likes of Prince, Jacko and Madonna and such. And it always was just this absolute sort of pinnacle of you know, my week. It was like Thursday nights, you watched the Pops. It was all about Thursday nights. Am I right in saying that you performed on there with Bernard when Yes come out?
I did Top of the Pops 3 times.
Right.
And Bernard.
Tell me about the first time you went on Top of the Pops. Did it, because I'm fascinated with people that have been on Top of the Pops, because it's such an institution, you know, in the UK. Did it deliver everything that you expected it was going to be? Because my vision, as you know, as a young lad, was once you go on Top of the Pops, you walk out of there with, like, firstly £1 million in the bank, and like, you know, you're instantly a superstar if you've been on Top of the Pops, and then you just get, you know, absolutely chased down the road by loads of sort of, you know, screaming children, all just absolutely adoring what you do. Tell me the realities of going on Top of the Pops, and was it everything you'd hoped it would be?
It was terrifying. And it was all terrifying. I think I spent most of 1995 after Yes came out being scared.
Of what? Of what?
Attention. You know, life had been a certain way, and that was okay. And then suddenly everybody recognized me. And that was really weird. And I remember, even though this is not an answer to your question, I remember after the Top of the Pops passing a crowd of teenagers outside Swiss Cottage tube station, because I was living up there at the time. And one of them, I just heard one of them as I passed saying, that guy was on Top of the Pops. And then they were they were all over me. And it's difficult to know what to do with that. So Rick Blacksill, I remember the producer of Top of the Pops, I remember being really warm. It was a very giddy experience. I mean, it was like a slow sort of state of shock. You know, when I heard that Yes went into the charts, it was like, you know, all of this stuff is unbelievable for me and difficult for me to process. And I think that the career I've had since then might actually be a reaction to, I don't know if I'm actually made for this level of attention. My favorite thing about visiting Top of the Pops was that it was at Elstree, and that's where they filmed EastEnders. And in the canteen, the EastEnders characters came in. I was watching EastEnders at the time. I remember Barbara Windsor.
No way.
In a leopard skin Mac. Like, I was standing in an entrance or something, and she just walked by and she looked at me. She said, "All right, darling," and kept going.
What a moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I remember my friend Patrick and I were there one afternoon, and the canteen was really empty, and we heard this dirty laugh kind of, behind us. And we turned around, and Steve McFadden and Ross Kemp were sitting at a table having lunch and a laugh together. And we were like, oh.
you said about you didn't, you know, you struggled with the instant, you know, onslaught of attention that come with, you know, going on the Pops. And did, what kind of conversations was you having with Bernard at that point? Because he'd obviously come from, you know, being very high profile in Suede at the time, and then kind of disappeared from Suede and then had returned with, you know, and I honestly mean, it's one of the greatest, you know, records ever made in Yes. I think it's as close to perfection as you can ever get, David. And your vocal on that is sublime, mate. Absolutely beautiful. Was you having conversations with Bernard about this kind of media attention and attention from people on the streets? Because obviously he must have experienced that. And from what I gather from documentaries I've watched on Suede and Bernard, he seemed quite uncomfortable with that in Suede as well. He seemed very much like wanting to be the studio guy. Like, what kind of conversations were you used to having there?
We didn't speak much. This might seem strange, but Bernard was actually quite guarded because of what he'd just been through with Suede.
Sure.
And because of some of his experiences with fans and being chucked out of the group, basically, which is how I understand it worked. I think the thing that I've understood about Bernard over time is that he's a regular bloke, really. I mean, he's a family man.
Yeah.
At that time, at that period when we were working together, he had a ritual. He'd get up in the morning, put on a boiler suit, and go to work in the studio, 9 to 5. And then when that was done, it was family time. And beyond that, I mean, he really, the way that he sees it, he is working for a living.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so that was certainly how it was at the time. Whereas I was just kind of in this kind of whirlwind of, well, I don't know what I was expecting. I mean, to me, the difficulty is that I'm David McElmond, and the success changed people towards me. And I was thinking to myself, I'm still him. I went to Tower Records to do a signing, and a young man stood in front of me to get his record. And he was nervous and he was struggling. I mean, I've done the same thing, so I know exactly what he was doing, but I was like thinking, yeah, but I'm David, I haven't changed.
Yeah.
You know, I just met this guy at the Jazz Cafe, and he said that he had been listening to a lot of Dusty Springfield and that he wanted me to record a song with him. Yeah. I went to his house, recorded a song with him, and then it went through all those processes, and then this happened. Yeah. I'm still the guy who was, you know, who went to this guy's house,
yeah,
because I liked the sound, because he had me at Dusty Springfield. And so, he's a regular guy. I've worked with him and been with him plenty, and he really just likes to be in a limited company where he's comfortable and he knows everybody.
Yeah.
And everything outside of that is a difficult place for him, I think.
Tell me the song that soundtracked your years clubbing, please, David.
This one was also easy. I mean, I think it's my favorite dance song ever. It's Rainey Lassiter doing the lead vocal on Hideaway with D. Lacey, and it's a deconstruction record. And I was always stunned that it was only 2.5 minutes long.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand now that it's an edit and that there are 7-8 minute versions of it out there, but it's just, I don't think there's another dance record that sounds like this.
Yeah.
It was such a singular moment in dance, but that kind of crunchy, grinding thing that somehow manages to be weightless and not tempo.
Yeah.
With her just, serving attitude for days over it. I mean, I love it to this day.
Yeah. Was clubbing a big thing for you? Was clubbing a big thing for you?
Well, there's one way to answer that question. I've been to Ibiza 14 times.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah, no, I loved it. The minute I realized, I remember standing in a club one night and realizing that the music that I was dancing to had been designed for where I was dancing to it.
Yeah.
You know, the scenario that it existed for no other reason.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it felt like to me. But yeah, I mean, I frequented Busby's when they had the Cop there, which was kind of queer core. I don't know if you've ever heard of queercore, but you have?
No, I haven't. No, please explain.
Yeah, it's sort of, if you think about New York Dolls, Blondie,
yep,
that sort of thing being reworked with a dance flavor.
That sort of CBGB's era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was that in the mid-90s, early noughties, that there was a lot of that around. So I liked that. Went to Heaven a lot. There was a happy house, happy soulful house club called Queer Nation that I went to pretty much every week. And then I went to Ibiza for the first time in 1999 and got absolutely hooked. And then it got, the number got so outrageous that I decided, best not, because every time I left Ibiza, it was painful. Right. I mean, you can imagine why, but I remember one time I left Ibiza, I was covered in glitter, sweating, and crying. Because, you know, you get into a certain state and you don't want to leave.
Yeah.
And my friends at the time called me Ever Eddie. Because I didn't stop dancing, and there's something about dancing and dancing and dancing for hours that when the dancing stops, it's still going on in your head.
Yeah,
I think there was actually a cartoon character called Ravy Davy in Viz or something.
That's right, there was.
No, I was like, you know, but you get on the ferry to Fort Monterra and you listen to the engine, it's just like, you know.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, look, we touched on you know, some of the early days, and that was unfortunately a fair few years ago now, and as you know, I've watched your career, you know, through to the recent work you've been doing with Sean. You've chose a ridiculously difficult industry to pursue. Yet you've maintained success. I asked you about confidence earlier, and now I want to ask you about drive. Are you a really driven individual?
Okay, I'll tell you how I see it. Yeah, I love to sing. I love writing. I love. I'm not mad about studios. I love the stage. And in many respects, the reason I love the stage is because once it's done, you can go home. Yeah. And you haven't got to think about it again. Whereas studios take you into underground rooms with no windows and air conditioning, which I don't enjoy at all. So thank God for the new age that we're in, whereby you don't have to do that anymore. So I recorded the last album with Sean on the 18th floor of a tower block overlooking London. It was and it was great. But I think that I'm a daydreamer and I sit around thinking about, you know, ideas. Oh, that would be really cool. That'd be really cool. And not doing anything about it. But somehow this thing has happened whereby I auditioned for Thieves, which was the first group that I was in, in the early 90s. And then Bernard got in touch with me, David Arnold, Craig Armstrong, Hi-Fi Sean. They all got in touch with me. During one of my daydreams. So I would say that my collaborators are the people who kind of coax me back.
Yeah.
Which is why so much time passes between records, because I'm sitting around daydreaming thinking, oh, that would be a good idea, wouldn't it? But then the phone goes, or Facebook, you know, I met Michael Nyman and Sean on Facebook, but they've said to me, and of course, being David, I've been like, you know, why are they asking me? But they've said to me, do you want to do something? And I've said, well, yes. So I've been very lucky with who has approached me. But that's why I'm still around doing this.
Yeah. Keep daydreaming, because if it's people like that that start getting in touch when you're daydreaming, you're doing something right, mate.
No, it's worked out really well. I'm very encouraged with it, but the Sean collaboration feels like a blessing, because he's really driven and he wants to get a record out next year.
Yeah.
And I've never done that in my life. Yeah. You know, it's been a few years that I've released something. So the idea that I might be in a situation to be prolific is exciting.
Fantastic. Sean's obviously back out with the Soup Dragons as well, right?
He is. I've been a very good vocal coach, because I have I've moonlighted as a vocal coach at points, and I've been having nice long conversations with Sean about, you know, how to manage it, because now that he's working with me, he's actually quite happy just doing the music and focusing on that, but returning to be lead singer has been a bit of a roller coaster for him.
Imagine.
So, you know, are you breathing right? Are you, like, you know, using your resonators correctly? Are you using the diaphragm?
I'm gonna take you home for track six, David. And if you could tell me a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Ha ha ha! You have played into my dastardly plan. All right, okay. Pontification time, soapbox time. The greatest singer to come out of Surrey is Julie Andrews. I adore Julie Andrews, and I love her the way that I love a singing teacher. I don't know why, but when I was young, my mother bought me a record, and she was very specific that she got it for me, and it was the Sound of Music album.
Yeah,
and this was the original Broadway cast recording with Mary Martin. Mm-hmm. It was written for, but I learned all the songs from her, And then I heard Julie doing them, and that on a level with Art Garfunkel, that was absolutely transporting. I listen to her every Christmas. I love that she's seen as the proper quintessential English Rose, and she is anything but. Many people will look at her and not know that in 2008, look at her life and career and not realize that in 2008 she revealed that she was the child of an affair. She was born in Walton Thames. She was a hoofer. She worked her way up from vaudeville to being one of the great legends of stage and screen. And I just think the world of her. And this is a song that I go back to all of the time, largely because the vocal is dry. There's no reverb on it or anything. It's just that purity. But if you want to learn enunciation and diction and breath and head notes, how to get all the way up there, you know, Julie and maybe a little bit of Babs, but Julie's girl, really. I mean, I remember Peter Curran a few years ago approaching me and like saying, David, you know, do you want to like sit down and maybe talk about doing a documentary? And I said, yeah, I want to make a documentary about Do Re Lump, Do Re Mi. And he was like, what? And I think that Julie Andrews was given the most significant job in the history of musical cinema. Because and I want to canvas the artist of my generation, because you listen to Do Re Mi, and not only does it explain what music is, but it teaches you how to write. And ever since I heard that song, I've known how to write one, because in the middle of it, the kids say, but it doesn't mean anything, and she says, so we put in words. One word for every note, and it goes a little bit something like, when you know the notes to sing, and bang, that's the moment at which I became a songwriter. And I know that I'm not the only one, and Julie Andrews is the person who gave the world that. So yes, I esteem her very, very highly. And this song is called Something Good from the Sound of Music.
Wonderful. Perfectly answered question.
I love Julie.
It's your last track, David, and I'm going to ask you to be Tastemaker. And it's a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
It's Hot Fun in the Summertime by Sly and the Family Stone. I think one of the things that I often think is that there's all of this music on Earth, but I haven't heard it 56. And there's a very real possibility that my time on Earth will be done, and I will not have heard the things that I really appreciate. Every summer, I compile myself a Spotify playlist for the beach. And this year, I went to a place called Malamocco. And last year was great. The playlist was called On the Beach, and it was all songs about the beach. And this year, it was just summery songs. And I researched, Googled songs about the summer, and Hot Fun in the Summertime came up. Hands up, I'd never heard this song before. And it once again, it was like, you know, where have I been? How have I lived this long without this song in my life? It's just beautiful. It's, summer is female, you know, end of the fall, and there she goes again. Bye, bye, bye to the summer days. And then it's got these wonderful euphemisms in it, like I can boop 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 if I want to. And then there's this lovely kind of Sesame Street section where they talk about being out of school, and it's just 3 minutes of heaven from the wonderful Sublime, from the wonderful Sly and the Family Stone. And I know Sly and the Family Stone, but somehow this one I missed.
Yeah,
I missed.
Well, we make it easy for people not to miss it because we put together, you just mentioned Spotify playlists, we put together a little Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast with all of your song choices and obviously some of your work as well, David. And with that in mind, what can people expect from you in the next months that are coming our way?
Well, I've been working with historic royal palaces in the University of Leicester on a film called Permissible Beauty, which is a composite contemporary portraiture series based on 17th century paintings at Hampton Court Palace. And so at the moment I'm promoting that. So it's going to be at the Wellcome Collection from October 26th for 6 months. That's an exhibition called The Cult of Beauty. It's for free, so you can go there and you can see the film. And I'll be up and down the country promoting that. Sean and I are going to start getting ready for the tour. We're hitting Glasgow, Manchester and London in February. So look out for that. It's I talk about it all on my Instagram page. We are working on the next album, and we are hoping that the album will see the light of day pretty soon next year. You can see me doing the George Michael songbook in December at the Twickenham Exchange. So check out the Exchange Twickenham website.
Oh, fantastic.
And that's one of the things that I do, which really fulfills the whole live, love to do live thing, and that's some songbook shows. So I did the Prince songbook in September, and I'm doing George Michael songbook in November.
Oh, wonderful. You touched on Instagram. If people want to keep up to speed with you, is that the best place to find out everything that you're up to?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if it's all right with you, David, when this episode comes out, we'll tag you in it. And if people aren't following you already, then they can do so.
Stu, thank you. It's been really good talking to you.
David, it's been absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for your time. I'm going to press stop.
Thanks for having me on this. You have some pretty significant people on this.
Well, I've got to be honest, David, as I said before, I've spent my whole life obsessed with music, and I do regard Yes as the greatest single of all time. And so it's been really lovely to speak to the voice of that record. So, yeah, so thank you so much. I'm going to press stop. Don't go anywhere. Oh, wow. I'm not going to lie. I was a little bit starstruck. And just because I remember the excitement of wondering what Bernard Butler was going to do, you know, as a sort of 18, 19 year old lad, wondering what Bernard Butler was going to do when he left Suede and kind of expecting something similar. And then I just heard Yes. And I just never, you know, you all know that Phil Spector's production and the Ronettes are some of, you know, the top of the pops for me. And to hear this voice that was just heaven sent in the shape of David McCormick's, you know, working with Bernard on this completely euphoric record that just screams joy. It just blew me away. So yeah, I was a little bit nervous and hopefully he didn't pick up on my nerves, but David was so delightful and yeah, I'm going to try and head down to the George Michael songbook. And you know, we mentioned the work he's been doing with Sean Dixon. Go check that record out. It's so good. And yeah, hopefully at some point, I have had a few chats with Sean about coming on. I'd love to talk to him. And certainly, you know, he's been working with David and obviously he's got an incredible career as a producer and DJ and now back with the Soup Dragons as well and touring with them. So he'd be a great guest. So at some point I'll try and get that one done. But in the meantime, go check out his recent record with David because it's a cracker. And why not go back and treat yourself to another blast of Yes and remind yourself why it's one of the most perfect records ever made. I'm back next time. In the meantime, be nice to each other. Thanks ever so much for listening. Go give us a follow on the socials. Why not go and check out the Patreon and spare 79p a month to support the podcast. And other than that, just give us a like, love, share or retweet on the socials. And I'll see you next time. Thanks again. Bye-bye.